From the state capitol, WFSU Public Media brings you Capitol Report.
Florida voters reject the constitutional amendment that would have legalized recreational marijuana use by adults. Many law enforcement officials are happy, but there are some who are not.
We've criminalized a lot of people, especially in the African-American community.
Also this week, why does Florida have a 60% voting threshold anyway? That's a question on many minds after most Florida voters cast ballots in favor of an amendment to protect abortion rights, but the proposal still failed.
Most legislatures, if they are controlled by one party for a period of time, typically don't like direct democracy as much.
We'll have several respected analysts delve into the many mysteries of the 2024 election, along with a number of predictions for what it might all mean going forward. I'm Tom Flanagan, and this is Capitol Report. As Governor Ron DeSantis celebrates the rejection of Florida's Amendment 3, marijuana experts are now weighing in on what's next for the drug. That story from Adrian Andrews.
Almost 6 million Floridians voted in favor of Amendment 3, which would have legalized the use of recreational marijuana for adults over the age of 21. According to the state's Division of Elections, about 56% of voters supported the measure, but it required 60% of yes votes to pass. Governor Ron DeSantis spent millions of dollars running ads and speaking at state-sponsored press events before the election, telling voters to vote down Amendment 3.
It's going to do damage to young people. It's just a question of how much damage.
The Florida Sheriff's Association came out against the measure, saying it would lead to more crime in the state, specifically with motorists driving impaired. Most sheriffs in the state got their wish on election night when the governor posted on Twitter announcing that Amendment 3 had failed. But not all law enforcement officials agree with the anti-marijuana stance.
We've criminalized a lot of people, especially in the African-American community.
Morris Young is the sheriff of Gaston County. He's also the longest-serving sheriff in Florida's history. He told WFSU after the election that he will continue pushing for marijuana reform policies.
Both presidential candidates was for legalizing marijuana. And I think you're going to see in the near future that marijuana is going to be legalized throughout America.
Under Amendment 3, Floridians would have been able to possess, purchase, or use marijuana products for non-medical reasons. But the amendment read that only state-licensed entities, like medical marijuana treatment centers, could grow and sell the drug. Governor DeSantis and others called that a red flag. Kim Rivers, the CEO of Florida's largest medical marijuana operator, Trulieve, told ABC Action News on Election Day that she's contemplating filing a lawsuit against DeSantis for using taxpayer dollars to fund his anti-weed campaign.
I think it's our responsibility as citizens and as taxpayers to hold our government accountable.
She then took to the News Service of Florida to discuss a plan that involves Trulieve working with the Florida legislature to expand medical marijuana access.
Folks care about this issue. Millions of Floridians signed the petition. Another, almost 6 million Floridians showed up at the polls. And we have an opportunity to, again, make some real change and some forward progress.
Florida lawmakers could weigh their options to expand the medical program during the next legislative session. I'm Adrian Andrews.
On Election Day, more than 57% of Floridians voted in favor of a state constitutional amendment that would protect access to abortion. But the proposal still failed, and a law that bans most abortions after 6 weeks remains in place. Regan McCarthy has this story about why amendments in Florida need a higher threshold, 60% approval, to pass.
Devastated. That's how outgoing state Democratic Senator Lauren Book says she feels when she thinks about the amendment results.
It's a difficult day when you have to look at your daughter in the face and know that you failed her.
Book has been an outspoken abortion rights supporter. She worries under the current ban, more women will see their abortions delayed or denied, and she's worried that will end up costing some of them their lives. She says it's frustrating to see that more than 57% of voters agreed women should have access to abortion up to the point of viability.
And because of this arbitrary 60% threshold, that is not going to be the case in Florida. And that is a very painful thing.
Some advocates have said the support from most voters sends a clear message to lawmakers. They're hopeful that could mean the state will repeal the current ban in the upcoming legislative session. Book says she's determined to keep fighting, but she calls that idea a false bill of goods.
Because with Ron DeSantis in the governor's mansion for the next 2 years, the reality is these laws will not change.
Book worries the vote has emboldened the state legislature. She's expecting a renewed push for a bill filed last session that some worried could pave the way for establishing fetal personhood. Abortion opponents are also looking ahead to the next legislative session. Andrew Sherville founded the group Florida Voice for the Unborn. He wants to see a change in the rules surrounding the petition gathering process, and he'd like to see the state pursue a total ban on abortion.
We think now we have the high ground with the people of Florida rejecting Amendment 4.
Sherville acknowledges their recent vote indicates most Floridians support abortion access, but he doesn't think those results are accurate. He says if people had a better understanding of what the proposal would do, he thinks more of them would have voted no.
But again, that doesn't really mean anything because a victory is a victory for our side. And they could have had 59.9%. And we still would have won.
All of that leads to the question, why does Florida require 60% approval for its proposed amendments to pass? As it turns out, that answer has something to do with pig farming.
The official name was Animal Cruelty Amendment Limiting Confinement of Pregnant Pigs.
Aubrey Jewett is a political science professor at the University of Central Florida. He says in the early 2000s, animal rights activists were concerned about pigs kept in small pens. State lawmakers were frustrated that voters wanted language around pig farming and high-speed rail, for example, added to the state constitution. Jewett says lawmakers felt like it was too easy for voters to go around them.
Most legislatures, if they are controlled by one party for a period of time, typically don't like direct democracy as much.
In 2006, Florida lawmakers put a proposal on the ballot that would require 60% approval for future amendments. Ironically, the measure passed with just under 58% of the vote. That was the last time 50% of the vote would pass an amendment. In recent years, lawmakers have filed bills to raise the bar to two-thirds. While historically that measure hasn't made it very far, some wonder if this could be the year. I'm Regan McCarthy in Tallahassee.
Coming up on Capitol Report, the old saying is it takes two to tangle, but there are those political analysts suggesting that only one national political party fought in Florida in advance of this week's election.
Basically, they gave up on Florida, and so the results speak for themselves.
Powerful Florida Republican shares his take on the election and how he saw it all coming.
That's how I came up with Trump with winning in between 12% and 13%, and that's how I knew that the amendments were going to be defeated.
And after all the election stress, perhaps seeking out spiritual sanctuary may help. We'll visit just such a place in South Florida. President-elect Donald Trump dominated in Florida on Election Day. He led by 13% over Democratic presidential candidate Kamala Harris. And that's a big jump compared to 2020, when he held about a 3% lead over President Joe Biden. Trump received more votes this cycle from Republicans. But as Tristan Wood reports, another part of the equation is that Democrats hemorrhaged support in places that were previously their strongholds.
Democrats won 11 Florida counties in 2020. This time around, they only won 6. In most of the ones they lost, it wasn't because Trump got more votes than in 2020, but that Harris underperformed Biden by significant margins. Even in counties she won, like Broward and Palm Beach, Harris's total was lower than Biden's, by 100,000 and 50,000 votes, respectively.
They didn't put the resources here to mobilize people and get them out to vote. So basically, they gave up on Florida, and so the results speak for themselves.
Barry University political science professor Sean Foreman says he thinks divisions in the Democratic Party and failure to paint a clear economic vision likely caused previous Democratic supporters to stay home. Miami-Dade Democratic State Senator and Harris Waltz campaign surrogate Chevron Jones says he thinks his party created a stronger vision for the future than Republicans, but he says that message failed to penetrate into everyday conversations.
The question is, was that translating to people's kitchen tables and the conversations that they were having with their families about their wallet and their finances? And obviously, yeah, if from the results we see, the answer probably is no.
In recent years, Florida has seen hundreds of thousands of people moving in and out. That has created one of the most fluid populations in the country and has been linked to spiking Republican voter registration in the state. University of South Florida Professor Emerita Susan McManus says Republicans have shifted their outreach efforts to meet the changing population, while she thinks Democrats have fallen behind.
It's really important that in a state that's as highly mobile as Florida, people moving in and out all the time and moving even within one county or one street to another, that the people who are in charge of get out the vote efforts be cognizant and attentive to the changing demographics of the population that they're trying to reach. It was pretty evident that Florida Democrats did not do a lot of deep dive into the changing demographics of Florida in various places, some better than others, and they suffered the turnout consequences.
After two blowout elections for Republicans in Florida, experts say it is looking more and more like Florida is a red state, with state Democrats struggling to swim against the red wave. I'm Tristan Wood.
Republican State Senator Blaise Ingolia of Spring Hill, a former state GOP chair, has won re-election. He was first election to the State House in 2014 and to the Senate in 2022. He's a close ally of Governor Ron DeSantis. He also made some accurate predictions that President-elect Donald Trump would win Florida by 12 to 13 points and the presidency with 291 electoral votes, and that Amendment 3, approving the use of recreational marijuana by adults, and Amendment 4, enshrining abortion rights in Florida's Constitution, would both fail. Ingolia spoke with Margie Menzel.
Congratulations.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
We are very impressed with the numbers that you predicted President-elect Trump's victory by, and wondering how you got them. Were you able to be so accurate?
I think I've been accurate ever since 2016 in predicting how Florida is going to come. I was one of the first ones on national TV to predict that Donald Trump was going to win the 2016 election. But, you know, the way I do it is basically I go into the polls, the public polls, and I readjust the polls for the way the voters actually vote in the state of Florida. So public polls do nothing but promote the pollster. They're not necessarily there to be accurate. So I go in and I start adjusting it and I started seeing the trends. Now with that, you also have to take into account the large voter advantages which party has during the vote by mail phase and the early voting phase. So when you put it all together, you know, a 1.2 million voter advantage after it was all said and done, figuring out how the MPAs are going to break, how many Democrats are going to come out still. That's how I came up with Trump with winning in between 12 and 13%, and that's how I knew that the amendments were going to be defeated.
Okay, the amendments were my next. On Amendment 3, would you say that failed because it was one giant company that was going to benefit?
I think that is a reason, but I don't think it's the only reason. I think that most voters in the state of Florida agree with decriminalization of marijuana. I don't think that anyone really thinks that you should land in jail for possession of small amounts. And I think everyone can agree with that. But this went a little bit step further. It went to full legalization without the legislature's ability to regulate it. And, you know, when you go to places that have full legalization, what you do is you can smell it almost everywhere. And I just think Floridians, because remember, we have the Open Indoor Air Act, I think that it's called, where you can't smoke in a lot of places. And just the fear of marijuana smoking in public was a little bit too far. So the amendment wasn't about decriminalization, it was about full legalization. Now, yes, there would have been a lot of companies that would have benefited from this. But I think the benefit also went a little bit too far, because if you were for full legalization slash decriminalization, you would have written it into the constitutional amendment that you were allowed to not only possess, but to grow it. Right. And I think that that proved to be a downfall.
So last year, you suggested making the Florida Democratic Party illegal.
And well, no, yes and no.
Okay.
The Ultimate Cancel Act said that the Secretary of State shall immediately decertify any political party that adopted pro-slavery tenets into their political platform. Never said which party did it, but then Nikki Fried, in all of her infinite wisdom, came out with a press release saying that, hey, you are going to decertify the Democrat Party. And we were like, gotcha, Nikki, because it was the Democrat Party that did that. It wasn't the Republican Party. So obviously it wasn't a proposal that we thought was going to see the light of day, but it was there to make a political point. And because I think that Black voters, not only in the state of Florida, but in the United States, are basically being taken advantage of by the left. They're being used for their votes. They're being promised things that aren't going to come to fruition. And the only thing that it benefits is the actual politician that are promising these things. So I think that's one of the reasons why you see Donald Trump now making historic inroads with Black voters. Is that he's basically, for the lack of a better word, and pardon my French here, he's calling BS on the Democrats and saying that, look, you haven't done anything for Black voters and Black communities. Voters are reward, Black voters specifically are rewarding with them. Now, there's plenty of inroads and work to be continued there, but there is obviously a realignment within politics where a lot of Black voters, especially Black men, are moving to the Republican Party.
Has the Florida Democratic Party canceled itself?
I think it has. I don't think the Democrat Party is a viable force. You know, when you start looking on a county by county outlook, the Democrat Party in a lot of counties are actually the third largest party behind MPAs.
That interview from Capitol reporter Margie Menzel. Of course, Republican candidates won every major race in Florida on Election Day. And the big question is, why did Democrats fare so poorly? WUSF Steve Newborn spoke with retired University of South Florida political scientist Susan McManus about why the party got trounced at the polls.
It was clearly an economic vote. We have seen from the beginning of this year, when asked the question, is the nation headed in the right direction? Almost two-thirds have said no, all the way through up to the election. And in Florida, half of the people, according to the exit polls, said the economy wasn't great. And previous polls have showed, even in Florida, a huge percentage said they're suffering economically. So that takes precedence over all the other kinds of issues. I think where Democrats went wrong was putting way too much emphasis on reproductive rights and abortion. That is important to some people, but consistently the polls were showing in Florida, it was never the top issue. So you have to win by getting an issue that reaches the largest number of people.
On paper, this looked like a really good year for Democrats to be running in Florida. A majority of people approved the abortion referendum, but it didn't get the 60% to pass. And women were focused in particular on Harris's campaign. So when you take those into consideration, it looks like the future for Democrats does not seem to be too bright in Florida.
Their biggest problem is how to communicate with the younger demographic. Democrats still have the idea that the younger vote is solidly liberal and democratic, when in fact, registrants in Florida, 40% were registered as NPA. I'm talking about Gen Zs and millennials, but almost equal percentages were registered as Democrats and Republicans. And even for young people, the economy was a big issue. And I think the future for Florida Democrats lies with the younger demographic, particularly young women. A lot of them ran for office. But the party just does not have a very good record on how to communicate with the younger voters in this state. They've struggled with it for two election cycles in a row now. And until they deal with that issue and really figure out how to communicate, they're going to continue to not do well in statewide elections.
Yeah, as you know, the Republicans added on to their supermajority in Tallahassee. Are Democrats becoming an endangered species in what used to be the country's biggest swing state? I mean, they don't seem to have much of a bench.
They don't have a bench, but some of that is a choice, a strategy. Yes, it's important to the party that they field candidates in all 120 House seats and 20 Senate seats. But if you just do that and you don't give any money or help, or you don't really help people communicate, especially a lot of these younger candidates know how to campaign, tap into networks of donors, it's not helpful. And so they're spread too thin. Their strategy would have been better to say, look, we're not going to make a huge comeback. We're going to go one step at a time. But instead, their proclamation day in and day out was Florida's still in play, Florida's still in play. It wasn't. When you have 1 million more Republican registrants than Democrats, that is hard to say that Florida's still in play. Let me just speak to the women's vote, because it is very diverse in Florida. The idea that all women are cohesively voting the same page, no, they're not. Registration-wise, I believe the numbers were like 37% registered Republicans, 36% registered Democrats of 24 or 25 NPAs and the rest other. That is not a group that is all going to be on the same page. So there was an expectation, I think, on the Democrats have an old idea of Florida, which is your persons of color, your women, and your young voters particularly are more prone to vote Democrat, maybe on some issues, but the economy was just overwhelming.
Susan McManus is a professor emerita at the University of South Florida. Thank you so much for your comments today.
Thank you.
You're listening to Capital Report from WFSU Public Media. I'm Tom Flanagan. Finally this week, a new exhibit explores the multitude of spiritual connections in the Miami area. More on that from WLRN's Natu Tway.
From voodoo and Islam to Santeria and Christianity, South Florida is home to various religious and spiritual beliefs. Sanctuary, Our Sacred Place, is the latest exhibit at History Miami Museum. Little Haiti photographer Wusler Delisfort dives into the religious and spiritual roots of Miami's indigenous, Caribbean, and African communities. Delisfort photographs the moments of divine connection that link these communities in mosques, temples, and churches. Where did you get the idea? You know, exhibit focus on the spirituality between the communities here in South Florida. How did that come about for you?
That project came during COVID. I was going out and documenting, you know, the Black Lives Matter protests
right
up in downtown. And I remember just sitting around just like, this is too much. This is too much for me. I fell into this slight depression. You know, I had to break away. So I remember going to the beach and just sitting down like, yo, man, this is too much. I can't handle this no more. I had a notebook with me, and I remember just writing down, I mean, where do we go to pray? You know, where is our sanctuary? And I just left it alone, just kind of tucked it in. And
right.
Then I remember just taking a 2-year break from photography. Then when the fellowship came about, as far as when I received the History of Miami Center for Photography, you know, I was thinking about what project I want to work on. What exactly do I want to tell about, you know, South Florida? And I remember going back and looking at some of the notes and have tons of different ideas, right?
Yeah.
But it's one thing said, sanctuary. You know, where do we go to
just
pray?
Popped up.
Just popped up. That was like the main, I mean, I'm looking at so many different, you know, voodoo in Miami. I'm looking into Little Haiti, because I'm from Little Haiti. I'm looking at so many different projects, but that one thing say, sanctuary, where do we go to pray at? I was like, you know what? Let me tap into this.
When you come in, what are we seeing?
All right, so, I mean, we have to think of a sanctuary, right? So with the sanctuary project, I had to bring not only the image, but also the elements to go with what a sanctuary looks like for us, right? No matter if you practice voodoo in the church, in Ifa community, any form, like I had to bring those different form of elements, right? So as you walking up them stairs to go to the gallery, what you will see is the actual church front. And what church I decided to build was the very first Black church in Miami, Mount Zion. Because again, it's giving homage to by community, right?
Right.
Because again, that church was our safe haven. You're walking in, and as you pass in this church, you see this huge potomita. Now, I'm just talking about just the installation. Huge potomita. So what is a potomita? In pretty much English term, it pretty much mean center pillar or pillar center. Like just a center pillar. Mm-hmm. But it's more than that, right? You know, when you go into a Paisil or Voodoo temple, you will find these huge potomita. And a potomita is pretty much is our connection with the earthly world and the unknown world, the ancestor world.
Like a bridge.
A bridge, a connection.
Right.
So now you went from coming to a church, good Christian Baptist church.
Right.
And the first thing you see is this huge potomita. And on the other side, you will see a Yamoja altar. That was built by Michelle Grant Murray. I really want to tie in also that because I'm a child of the water. I love the water. Mm-hmm. So now you're seeing different installment to goes in with the image.
For those that don't know, what is that altar?
So the Yamoja altar is pretty much is the altar for the queen of the ocean. She the one that, you know, she bring you abundance. It kind of ties in with my photo essay that dealing with the water.
Mm-hmm.
So again, it's bringing back spirituality.
Usler highlighted the efforts of his co-curators who encouraged him and helped him bring the physical and spiritual pieces of his exhibit to life. Marie Vickles, the director of education at the Perez Art Museum Miami, explained why it was important to have the physical representations of these spiritualities in the exhibit.
Well, I think it places you, right? When you walk into the space, an exhibition is a physical experience.
Right.
There's a reason we're seeing it in person and not virtually. During COVID, I know a lot of museums, galleries tried to like create online exhibitions and they were successful doing it, but there's still something that you don't experience in a physical space. We're physical beings, right? So to bring in these different elements that you see in the photographs, it brings you even, I think, deeper into these experiences, wow. You know, like the potomita, the altars. You see the altar or pieces of it in some of the photographs, and then you see an altar right there, and it really grounds you like into what you're experiencing in that space.
Usler felt it was important that the leaders of the various spiritual communities also played a role in building and crafting the altars in this project. Iriola Olaifa helped gather these leaders and practitioners who in turn placed their blessings on the space through their involvement.
Each person was different. For example, Miss Michelle Murray, who's a dancer, and she was involved in this project in multiple ways.
Wow.
This woman is extremely dynamic, doing amazing things in Miami in terms of movement and dance. That incorporates spirituality. So it really made sense. And her and Musler have a really long relationship. So, you know, her altar was Yamaya. And, you know, she has been around the spiritual system for such a long time that she was able, as a child of the way, to incorporate different aspects in a very artistic way. It's one of my favorite installations in there because I'm a daughter of Yamaya. And from even having the light of water just kind of flow onto the altar itself as a visual effect.
Sanctuary, Our Sacred Place is the latest exhibit at History Miami Museum. You can experience it until January 26. I'm Natu Twe in Miami.
Our regular Capitol Report correspondents are Adrian Andrews, Lynn Hatter, Regan McCarthy, Margie Menzel, and Tristan Wood. Thanks also to Steve Newborn and Natu Twe. Technical support for Capitol Report comes from Taylor Cox, and I'm Tom Flanagan. We hope you'll join us again next week on air and online for more reports from the state capitol.
Capitol Report is a production of WFSU Public Media in Tallahassee.